I'm Dan Gottlieb. Thanks for listening to Voices in the Family. Today we're going to be talking about raising caring, compassionate kids who have a wider vision of what it means to be happy, well-being. My guests are Dr. Madeline Levine. She's written the New York Times best-selling book, The Price of Privilege and Teach Your Children Well. We're going to be talking with Dr. Tamar Chansky. She's the author of many books, including Freeing Your Child from Anxiety, and she writes for WHYY's Newsworks here. But first, we're going to be talking with Luba Falk Fagenberg. She's a partnership manager for Making Caring Common Project at Harvard Graduate School of Education. Luba, welcome to the show.
Thank you. Thank you so much for having me.
Well, let's start with the project. What is it? What's Making Caring Common?
Making Caring Common is a project housed at the Harvard Graduate School of Education, and we do research and public education that is aimed at elevating caring for others in child raising and in schooling. We also work to give parents and schools concrete strategies and resources that they can use in their everyday interactions with young people. And we are starting a youth campaign that's aimed at empowering young people to be active participants in raising the awareness about caring and concern for others as well.
So I'm curious, are most people buying in to the importance of this, or are they saying, we've got other stuff, we'll get to it when we have time?
That's a great question. Most people are absolutely on board that caring and empathy and a commitment to justice is critically important to the way that we raise our children and to the world around us. What we're finding, actually, interestingly, is that there's a gap between what people are saying is important to them and what kids are hearing and seeing in the messages that adults spread.
You've got a list of tips for raising caring children. One is to develop a caring, loving relationship with your kids. Well, you know, any parent would say, I already do that. So what does a caring relationship look like and feel like? You know, in our lingo, we've got something called anxious attachment.
So I think it's great that most parents believe that they already have caring relationships with their kids and that that is a concern for them and a goal for them. I think what we talk about is making sure that that message of caring and respect is demonstrated in the relationship between children and parents in everyday interactions.
Yeah, go on. I want to know what that looks like.
Absolutely. So that means spending time together regularly and really setting aside time to do things together and to share activities together that are about connecting and getting to know each other. It means having meaningful conversations and asking real questions so that children have an opportunity to share what's been going on in their day, to talk about what they think and what they feel about things going on around them, and to hear from their parents that parents have real experiences during their days, too, that they want to share with their children.
So you said asking children important questions, meaningful questions. That's easy to do, but then there's the listening problem that parents sometimes have.
Mm-hmm. Yes. Listening is a really important thing for children to experience from the adults around them, and we can show children that we listen to them by reflecting back to them what we've heard and asking a question that continues the conversation. And we also have to give children an opportunity to learn how to actively listen, which means using your body to demonstrate that you are paying attention and to asking those same kinds of follow-up questions that we model for them.
Interesting. So I know you're recommendations are based on solid research that you've done and are still doing. You did a survey, if I got this right, with up to 10,000 parents and kids over time, and you rated the importance of caring, happiness, and achievement. Who, mm-hmm. What did you find, and who did you survey?
So as part of our project, we have a network of schools around the country called the Caring Schools Initiative, and schools sign on to do a school climate survey with their students, their teachers, and their parents each year. And we have more than 50 schools from around the U.S. that have signed on to take the survey. So last year, we had over 10,000 students, and you are correct. We asked them to tell us in rank order what is most important to them, caring for other people, achievement, or happiness. And what we found is that 80% of kids rate their individual personal success, either happiness or achievement, as the number one thing that is most important.
What's the age range?
Middle and high school, so 12 through 18-year-olds.
Okay. That's kind of sad. They're talking about personal happiness, right?
Personal happiness, right. And so we also ask them to tell us what they think is most important to the adults in their lives. And similarly, 4 out of 5 students tell us that the adults in their lives prioritize achievement and happiness over caring for others. But what's most interesting to us is that when you ask the adults, when you ask the parents and the teachers that same question, they overwhelmingly say that caring for others is the most important thing. And so we talk a lot about how the messages that we send to kids about caring for other people, understanding people who are different from you, and really being connected, those messages are being overwhelmingly drowned out by the messages that are sent to kids about the importance of achieving.
Well, there's one thing about sending messages to kids, talking to them about it, and there's another mm-hmm. thing about what they see in the world, and see at home even.
Exactly. And we talk a lot about the importance of being a good role model, which again, I think is something most people say, oh, I know that that's important. And there's a lot to be said for those everyday interactions that we have and questioning what messages we are sending to kids when we say it's important to care for other people, but then what we praise kids on or what we give them recognition for is achieving in school.
You know, it's very easy to say to parents, here's what you should do. But that's tantamount to saying, you've got to change your life now. You've got to change the way you live your life. You've got to address your own values. That's hard to do.
It is very hard to do. And as a parent of young children myself,
yeah.
It is humbling to do. And I think it's critically important that we do as much as we can to be aware of what we are doing when we are around our kids. And part of being a good role model means that we accept the fact that we are not perfect, and we make mistakes or we don't do things in the way that we might hope that we do things. And that those are opportunities to talk to our kids too and to say, you know what? That thing that I did yesterday didn't feel so good, and I want to talk to you about that. Or I was wrong when I talked to you in that tone of voice, and I try not to do that, but sometimes I get frustrated too. And I think that helps kids know that we all have moments where we make a mistake, and that we can learn from those, and that that's the most important thing.
The problem here is, and you know, I'm just a clinician, so I see the micro issues here
mm-hmm.
in my office. So the problem is you're really asking a family, you're asking parents to go from 80 miles an hour inside their heads and outside their lives to down to 55. I'm talking about their lives, not just their approach to their children, asking them to rethink their lives, because we want more from them than just acting in a certain way for the sake of their children.
I think that part of it is slowing down, which is a challenge for all of us in our fast-paced world. I also think it's about really being clear about what our priorities are and acting on those as well. So I think part of what we find in our research is that the focus on caring for other people is not being prioritized. And that we say that we want it to be a priority, parents say that they want it to be a priority, but they're not acting on that. And so I think what we're talking about is questioning ourselves continually to look at whether our said priorities are in line with our acted priorities, and to take the steps to try to align them a little bit more. And again, nobody is going to be able to achieve that 100% of the time, but the more that we can check in with ourselves and check in with other people and get feedback about how we're doing, the closer we'll be able to be.
If you're just tuning in, you're listening to Luba Falk-Fiegenberg. She's a partnership manager of the Making Caring Common Project at the Harvard Graduate School of Education, and that's what we're talking about today, the whole show. We're going to be talking about raising compassionate children and becoming compassionate parents. Our number, by the way, is 888-477-9499. Again, that's 888-477-9499. Luba, let's talk about schools and what role they have to play here and exactly how you intervene at that level.
So schools are a critical context for children's development of themselves, of their skills and abilities to interact with other people, and to really participate in a community. And so schools have a huge responsibility in making sure that the atmosphere within schools is safe, is supportive, and really encourages the values that we've been talking about in children.
How?
So at our project, we have spent a lot of time developing resources and strategies for teachers and for schools that can be used to really integrate a focus on caring and understanding difference and a commitment to justice into everyday interactions. And we believe that these are not things that need to be expensive or huge financial resources for schools, but they do require commitment on behalf of the adults that it is important to bring into the day.
What kind of are you able yet to measure outcome?
We are starting to think about ways to measure outcomes at a large scale. Right now, we're really looking closely at schools that are using some of these strategies and working with them to figure out what are some differences that they are seeing in the short term and the long term.
Well, that's pretty impressive. I unfortunately, we have to take a short break and we have to say goodbye to you. I'm so grateful to you, Luba, for not just joining us, but for the very important work you're doing. And I wish you great funding and great success.
Thank you so much. It was really an honor to be here.
Thank you, Luba.
Thank you.
We're going to take a short break on our show. We're talking about raising not just caring kids, compassionate kids who maybe want to help others. And how to do it. We're going to take a short break. When we come back, we're going to speak with Dr. Tamar Chansky, author of many books, but probably her best-known books are Freeing Your Child from Anxiety and Freeing Your Child from Negative Thinking. We'll also be speaking with Dr. Madeline Levine. She's written The Price of Privilege, which was a New York Times bestseller. She's also co-founder of Challenge Success, a project of Stanford School of Education. And our number, by the way, is 888-477-9499. We'd love to hear from you. Well, I'm Dan Gottlieb. You're listening to Voices in the Family right here on WHYY FM.
Karen Treatment Center supports WHYY. Is someone you care about struggling, losing interest in activities they loved? Changes like these can be a sign of drug and alcohol abuse. As a behavioral health care and addiction treatment center, Karen helps families understand when professional help is warranted, offering therapies that restore wellness in body, mind, and spirit. A confidential assessment is available at 855-894-4325 or at karen.org. That's CARON.org.
The Philadelphia Foundation supports WHYY. The Philadelphia Foundation helps make nonprofits stronger, offering workshops and services designed to increase effectiveness and build the capacity of organizations throughout southeastern Pennsylvania. The Philadelphia Foundation can help you support the organizations you care about today and forever while you receive tax deductions. The Philadelphia Foundation, 215-563-6417 or online at philafound.org.
We are back on Voices in the Family. I'm Dan Gottlieb, your host. We're joined now by Tamar Chansky and Madeline Levine, both of whom have been on the show before. I want to start with you, Madeline. Thanks so much for joining us.
Well, thank you, Dan.
And Tamar, welcome. Welcome back.
Thank you, Dan.
It's good to be with you. Let's start with you, Madeline. Do you think what we are seeing might be partly a failure of empathy between parents and children?
I'm sorry, Dan, the first part of your sentence cut out. Can you say that again?
Sure. Do you think partly what we are seeing is a failure of empathy between parents and children?
You know, I think you made a really great point when you were talking to Luva about how much has to change. I think that's exactly right. I think empathy starts very early, very, very early, in the way a mother looks at a child, responds to a child, whether you call it mirror neurons or attunement or whatever. It's the ability to read your child accurately. So all the things that happen later are important as strategies for teaching kids to be more compassionate. But I think that we are so incredibly busy and so distracted that the simple act of accurately reflecting back to your child what you see, who they are, is lost. And I do believe that's a failure of empathy. And I think it has very negative consequences going forward.
Tamar is sitting here across the desk from me, and she has the misfortune of having me read her expressions. So I'm seeing an expression. So you're safe, Madeline, but poor Tamar. So
I'm going to have to come clean here, huh?
Yeah. So,
you know, when you were talking earlier about the idea that we're asking so much more from parents, maybe I'm being delusional, okay? But I think we're asking different from parents. This is what I see every day in my practice, that what we have to do, and we're modeling this for our children, is not going with our first reaction, which is, you know, apologize now, or say you're sorry for that, or, you know, you shouldn't have done that. It's really about it. How do we empathize or help our children to empathize is we have to be real people there and be patient, understanding that learning kindness is, it's not an automatic thing. It's not a fire we have to put out when our kids are unkind. It's really, it's a teachable moment. It's a fixable moment. And we have to be willing to be patient and give them a second chance and believe that their best self is there and just ask them to try again. Much better results on the second time.
Well, let me pick up on a little piece of education I just got from Madeline, that should we ask the child, should we have compassion for the child who, quote, behaved badly, and wonder what was going on with you that you did that or felt that way? You know, were you upset about something?
Can I respond to that?
Yes.
I think we absolutely have to respond to the child, and that, you know, kids are not by nature out to be miserable people in the world. Kids kind of follow a course of moral development on their own. If we can utilize the way kids think about what's right and what's wrong, then we stand a better chance of being able to speak in their language. So, you know, you don't give a very young child a long social explanation. You just tell them it's the right thing to do. But I think the bigger issue is that we actually are caring about the wrong things. My experience is that we're in a particular time in America where there's bifurcation in the economy and bifurcation in politics and bifurcation in education. And kids know that their parents, you know, we can say the right thing, but that doesn't mean it's what's heard, or, as Luba pointed out, it's not what kids really believe about their parents. And so your child comes home from school and the first thing you say is, how'd you do on that math test? It's absolutely clear to that child what matters most to you. And if those are the things that matter most, not what you say matters most, but that you act on, then that's what the child takes. And I think it's a mistake to blame the child for being uncaring. The child learned a set of rules, which, by the way, will not stand them in good stead. About half of my speaking now is at businesses, collaboration, working together, being a good person, all the things we used to call soft skills. Those are the things that are valued by companies increasingly. And we're not teaching those kids those skills, so yeah, they're at a disadvantage when they're young, in school, and in the workplace.
I got to tell you, hearing that about business warms the cockles of my heart. So I don't even know what cockles are, but it just seems like the right thing to say. Let's go to the phones apropos of bifurcation. Dana?
Yes. Hi. Yes. I wanted to know how the research extends itself to the characteristics of empathy and compassionate that parents might model for their children towards other beings. I often think about how racism continues and sexism and homophobia and these things continue through each generation in our country, because oftentimes the messages that our children are receiving, even if they're not verbal messages, but how their parents are treating other people, and how I learn only to be empathetic and compassionate to people who look like me, and that people who don't look like me, I do not have to demonstrate those characteristics.
Well, let me.
How does your research speak to that?
Let me follow that up. I want to turn that to you, Tamar, and that, you know, as anxiety goes up, I would think it diminishes our ability to see a bigger picture, that it gets us more focused on ourselves and those right around us.
Right. They're sort of polar opposites that when we are generally in threat mode, kindness will be the antidote to that. And I think, you know, what the caller is saying is that the more that parents are modeling for their children, the connections that we have rather than the differences, there's less of that, you know, status quo of being in that threat mode.
I want to follow something up with you, Madeline, and that's this, that anxiety does go up, but Dana was talking about the isms, you know, the racism, the sexism, the prejudice, and all of those isms are really natural and normal. They're part of our evolutionary genes, that we're hardwired to look askance at people or animals that look different than we did, because they could jeopardize our lives. But the cure for that, all these isms, or most of them, are based on ignorance. Just make eye contact with one of the isms and, you know, get to learn about those people. And I think that's our responsibility as parents.
Well, and I think we see that in really small ways. By the way, none of this is fast enough, but there certainly have been significant structural changes in this country around a lot of those isms. I'm not saying it's adequate, but social change is slow and hard. But I think you teach that in very small ways every day. You know, one of the things I see in my community, which is pretty affluent, is, you know, the moms are standing around getting their lattes, and the kids are right next to them, and mom is dismissive of the Hispanic in my community guy behind the counter. I actually think that's the way you make change, is by modeling it yourself, and you don't let the kid who says something dismissive to that guy behind the counter, you don't let him get away with it. And I think that this takes a community. The places that I've seen that are successful in creating a more caring culture, it's not just the school, it's not just the parent, the whole community comes in. The guy behind the counter, the janitor, the cop down the block, and decides what the values of the community are. And when that young boy is standing behind the counter and saying something, you know, snarky about girls, everybody turns to them and says, you know, that's really not cool, as opposed to right now where it goes unnoticed. By the way, Dan Cockles, just so you know, a ventricle's in your heart.
Really? Thank you. Thank you.
You're welcome.
Now, God willing, I'll remember that till the end of the show. But it's iffy here. It's iffy. I want to turn to you here, Tamar, just about that issue. So if I'm snapping at somebody behind a counter or pushing in line for someone, I'm being a terrible role model for my child. But, or and, if I am doing that, I am suffering in that moment. I'm distressed. There's something going on inside of me that's very, very uncomfortable causing that behavior. And I don't even know it.
There could be lots of things going on for you that you may not know. Some you may know, some you may not be aware of. What do we do to, I really think about the nitty-gritty here. So we've talked about how after the fact parents can kind of apologize or explain what was going on for them if they're able to. That's great. But I want to put out the idea of shame, Dan,
mm-hmm.
because I think that so much of how we can do this not constructively or less constructively is thinking that there is this absolute right and wrong. And that, let's say, going back to our children, that when it's not happening, that they have done something wrong. And that by, you know, putting that kind of shame on them, the learning experience will not happen as well as if we can, again, kind of slow it down, try to find out what was going on for them. And the research that I've seen about character is really talking, I was talking earlier about best self, talking about, you know, I know you're not the kind of person who wants to hurt someone's feelings, but it looked like something was going on there. What was going on? And having that conversation.
You're talking about the parent or the child?
Well, right. Exactly. Exactly. But if you are looking for that good behavior, you kind of have to make a way for it to come out. Shame is not the way to bring it out.
You know, the oversimplified definition of shame is that shame is about the self. Shame is who you are. Guilt is what you've done. And shame is much more debilitating than guilt. I would also argue, and I'd love to hear your thoughts about this, Madeline, that if you are behaving so as to avoid shame, you're living with shame already.
Yeah, absolutely. But I'm going to take a slightly harder line view on this. And that is that, you know, it's kind of you to say that parent is feeling guilty or shamed and they're uncomfortable and that's why they're pushing in line. That may be true, but at the end of the day, it's still not okay. And frankly, just because of where I am and who I tend to work with, it's not always guilt and shame. It's often a sense of entitlement that you know, I'm special, and I get to push to the front of the line. And what a child sees is not the underlying drivers of that bad behavior. All the child sees is that normative, acceptable behavior. And I think that bodes really badly. So when you said earlier on, you know, this is really a tough deal for parents, you're asking them to do a lot, my answer to that is yes. But look at what's going on with kids in this country. Look at the rates of depression and anxiety and suicide and substance abuse. I mean, all is not well in this country. And that's a parent's job, is to protect and raise children who will sort of carry forward. And, you know, I don't think we just get to say it's too tough. I think we have to say, I'm going to hold you to this standard, because if I don't, it's bad for you, it's bad for your child, and it's bad for the country.
All right, so Madeline, you just raised my anxiety, and now I have to make an appointment to see Tamar. And that's a schlep to her office.
Well, why did it raise your anxiety?
Well, because, you know, when you talked about what's happening in the country, and there was a kind of urgency, I heard, as a parent and, well, a grandparent now, but, you know, a kind of urgency that, damn it, you must do this.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's right. That's right, because, you know, I've been basically on the road for a decade, Dan, and so have a whole bunch of other people, been doing the exact same thing. And I have a project at Stanford, and there are projects at Harvard. There are projects everywhere on this. And yet, rates of depression are up. Rates of anxiety among children are up. Rates of suicide are up. Eating disorders are up. Cutting is up. Well, you know, the mental health of children in this country is poor. And if it means taking a hard look at ourselves in order to correct some of those things, and they are correctable. I mean, I've been to schools that do a fabulous job of attempting to correct some of the what I see as deficits. I think they are correctable, and I do think they take some hard work. And I think I've been doing it long enough to feel, look, guys, the trajectory is not going in the direction we want. It simply isn't, in spite of all this intervention. So we have to take a long, hard look at ourselves and really change some fundamental things, like how busy we are, how distracted we are, how entitled we can be ourselves, in order to move the needle on this.
Well, before we go to the phones, I just want to comment here. We've got several people who want to join the conversation. I would just, one of my many mantras is that nothing changes without safety. And, you know, if everybody, I'm talking about therapists, parents, mm-hmm. everybody can take a deep breath, slow down, mm-hmm. reflect, be kind to yourself, and then we can hold hands and learn to be kind to each other. But
absolutely. But self-reflection means that you, which I think is the most important variable in here, means that you have a moment a day to sit down and think about what you're doing. You're not constantly checking your email. You're not overwhelmed by, you know, multiple things. And I think we've lost that capacity.
Let's go to the phones here. We've got Mary on the line.
Yes.
Hi, Mary.
Hi. Listen, I find this whole conversation interesting and also very anxious in its effect on me, anxiety level. But I think it's very important because I am a 67-year-old grandmother, and I see that I was taught and learned from my parents that kindness and all of those good things, you started at home with those in your family, and then you worked outward with those with your friends and your playmates and all those you came in contact with and showed respect to those people. My concern is what's happening with the parents and the very young children, where the grandparents are seeming to be discarded, not valued as they once were. And I think they have a lot to offer the children as far as learning these important issues and learning how to be better and not be left behind. And I feel sorry for my grandchildren and for my children. I don't want their lives to keep going in this direction.
Let me press you here, Mary, just you and me.
Okay.
When you say you feel sorry for them, unpack that emotion. What is the emotion that you feel?
Well, their lives are distracted in so many ways. As you said, the internet and the iPhone and all of those great tools, you know, are on the cutting edge of all of that. I understand. But parents, I see parents all the time with their children, and their children are disengaged because the parent is
Mary, I'm not challenging feel this. What I want to know is, inside of you, what are the emotions behind feeling sorry for? Because for me, when I feel that, it's very often sadness, helplessness, and love.
I feel all of those.
Okay, so we can start there. And I wonder what would happen if you expressed your emotions to your children. Just say that's how you feel, not with an agenda, not with what they should do or what might happen or what you could do. Just that's how it feels to love you and bear witness to what's happening, period. And then you can start a conversation. And maybe they can be open with you, too. You know, if you can reflect, talk about role models, which is what we've been doing. If you can role model opening your heart and being vulnerable and expressing your love, perhaps they can also. And then maybe everything will slow down. Maybe, you know, we can hope. Just my two cents.
I do try to do that. I do.
Well,
I just see. Yes.
Just lead with your heart. That's my only advice. Just lead with your heart and not your thoughts.
That's great advice.
All right, yeah. Mary. I wish you the best as a fellow grandparent.
Thank you.
Thank you.
You too.
Well, we've got to take a short break right now, and we'll be back with more calls and more discussions and more ideas about what we can do with Tamar Chansky, the author of Freeing Your Child from Anxiety, Madeline Levine, who's written The Price of Privilege, and both have written other books also. Our number, if you want to join the conversation, is 888-477-9499. Again, that's 888-477-9499. How do we teach our kids kindness? How do we change our own lives around so that kindness, compassion, and making the world a better place is more of a priority? Well, I'm Dan Gottlieb. You're listening to Voices in the Family right here on WHYY FM.
Supporting WHYY, Yampolsky Law PC, a law firm based in Tree Rose, Pennsylvania, focused on transforming conflict through mindful practices of collaborative law, mediation, family law, and labor and employment law. More information at conflicttransformed.com.
Penn Medicine supports WHYY. Are you interested in long-term weight loss? Then you may be eligible for a research study offered by Penn Center for Weight and Eating Disorders. This 16-month research study combines a behavioral weight loss program with an FDA-approved weight loss medication. More information is available on how you may be eligible to participate at 215-746-5030. 215-746-5030.
It's America's Test Kitchen Live.
Hi, I'm Christopher Kimball. Join me for a live performance and an insider's behind-the-scenes view of America's Test Kitchen.
Wednesday, October 21st at the Merriam Theater. More at whyy.org/events.
We are back on Voices in the Family. I'm Dan Gottlieb, your host, with Drs. Madeline Levine and Tamar Chansky. Tamar, you indicated you wanted to follow up my comments to Mary right before the break.
Yeah, I was thinking that one thing we haven't talked about so far, but you just started it, is the fact this is the PR campaign that we're missing here. is the fact of how good it feels when you are kind. Is that something to overlook? I mean, when we're talking about doing something different or harder or whatever, imagine, you know, I'm thinking of Mary in her conversation with her children. That could end with a wonderful connection. And that's what can be very reinforcing, too. So I don't want to lose sight of that. And actually, I was reading about a middle school curriculum about teaching kindness and compassion. And one of the things that they did was to have students make their own kind of PR videos for sort of catching kindness and compassion in the hallways. Why not have kids own this and make that something, you know, yes, we want the parents to value this, parents do value it, but kids, it's their own, this is their world that they're creating and inheriting, but creating, they have a say. Why not have them show us where kindness is?
That's just beautiful.
I have a similar story, and I just came back from Boston from a school outside of Boston in Manchester that had an amazing SEL curriculum, which, by the way, every school in America should have, socio-emotional learning. And I was really interested. One of the things they did, they gave every third graders a clipboard and told them they were social scientists and brought me in and introduced me. And then they had the kids go out and learn the scientific method of observation. And then they came back to report on their observation, but really underneath this protocol for this particular lesson was how to stand in somebody else's shoes. So they got to observe. They felt very special with their clipboards as social scientists, and they got to catch people doing things, and then they got to try and stand in their shoes. There's one thing I want to say about this, the kinds of examples that we're showing right now, you and I, tomorrow, and that's, see, I don't really think that kids don't know what it means to be kind. I think, you know, every school you go to in America, there's banners, character and kindness and empathy all over the place. I think it's a question of motivation, of making it an important thing to be, of valuing it all over the place. So you can walk into a school, 90% of the schools I walk into, there's the exact same thing in the hallway, the honor roll and the athletic cabinet. But there are also schools where you walk in and there's photography and ceramics and human-powered vehicles on the ceiling and a whole bunch of different things, and it says this is what we value here. Most of the kids I treat know very well the right and the wrong things to do. They're just not particularly motivated because they don't see any benefit from it.
Which underscores Tamara's point that the benefit is that it feels good. Let's go to the phones. We've got Vicki on the line. Hi, Vicki.
Hi, Dan. I just want to start off first by just thanking you. You are and honoring you. You're just a gift of a man, and everything that you do for those that you touch. So I really only listen to you on the radio show when I can, but you're a wonderful human being, and thank you for spreading yourself.
Bless your heart.
To everyone. But quickly, what I wanted to talk about, and I like what you're talking about with the kindness and acknowledging kindness, and let's, you know, kind of all remember, too, that when, you know, sometimes the kindest are the toddlers and the young ones, and then they kind of learn through adults how sometimes not to be kind. So I still think that teenagers, although they're going through all their angst in children, they have a lot of hormones going on, but they still haven't been as jaded as the adults are, and they've still got a whole heck of a lot of kindness in them, which, you know, I honor. I've got teenagers, and I see. So that's, I just want to say that just a little bit. But my big thing that I would love to share is that we as a society are saying, especially adults, part of our conversation, it's not the weather anymore, it's how busy we are. Oh, we're busy. Oh, we're so busy. Well, as I shared with the woman when I called in, you know, the cavemen were busy. And, you know, people have always been busy. It's just different. You know, we actually have more leisure time, and we've turned it to technology because we're not having to work in the fields all the time, or we're not in the factories. And, you know, things are, you know, so we've actually created more leisure time, and we've replaced it with technology. So we're just as busy as we've always been, but we just have to be careful with what we're messaging to our children, you know? And so I kind of wanted to put that out there. People who are listening, we just kind of step back and think about that not being how we define ourselves and how busy we are. It's a very American thing, too, I think.
Yeah, that's a really good point. That's like our badge of honor that we are destroying ourselves with our busyness. Nice. Thanks so much for your point, Vicki. Listen, I want to continue with the phones because there's a lot of people want to join the conversation. We've got Lenny on. Lenny?
Because there's a lot of people want to join the conversation.
Lenny, if you're there, I got to ask you to turn the radio off.
Lenny?
Yes. Can you hear me?
Yeah. Could you turn your radio off, please?
Yes. Can you hear me?
Lenny? Yes.
Can you hear me now?
Yeah, not until you turn your radio off.
Oh, sorry. Yeah, thank you. I always enjoy your program. We are indebted to you for all that.
Thank you.
You have cured by your kindness and your compassion so many just by listening.
Thank
Dan,
you. Yes.
Do you hear me?
I do, very well.
Yeah, yes. Dan, I have written to you. I have sent you emails also on this aspect. Today, I want to tell you that my grandmother, who was born in 1872, I'm now 70 years old, from Sri Lanka, she was a very compassionate lady, kind, and she taught us so many things. You know, Dan, one example, this one will, I think, will... give some food for thought to everybody. On Good Friday, though she was a Buddhist, she didn't allow us to turn on radio music. And she explained to us why our relatives and friends who were Christians were fasting on that day and so on. So that's how my grandmother taught us compassion and love. Love of other religions, love of others who professed other religions and philosophies and so on. And remember, this was a lady who was born in 1872. Hmm. Thank you.
What a wonderful woman she sounds like. Lenny, I'm so glad you had her in your life. I was listening to Lenny. I'm thinking the greatest lesson I got from my grandmother is how to not get caught stealing cookies out of my mother's cookie jar. And that was a very important lesson. It, you know, paid me well. You know, Lenny makes an important point about experience, empathy, in your life, and it almost doesn't matter where it comes from. And you know, just on a neurochemical perspective, it doesn't matter whether you're giving it or receiving it. It feels the same in your body.
And, you know, one of the things that happens when you talk to parents who are pretty anxious about their kids, how their kids are doing, how they're stacking up, you know, what their grades are, where they're going to go to college and stuff, is I'll often tell the story of my best parenting moment. So I have three sons who are grown. And without a doubt, my best parenting moment comes when my youngest son, who's working and he's 22, gets a bonus, and I ask him, oh, that's great, you know, you haven't said anything about what you're going to do with it. And he said, well, I donated it. And I said, where and what made you do that? And Ronald McDonald, whatever. And then he looks me right in the eye, and he said, I did it, Ma, because it was the right thing to do. That's my best parenting moment. And I would suggest that for most parents, it's not going to be where your kid got into school. It's not going to be whether they got a 4 or 5 on their AP test. It's going to be the moment when your kid looks at you and you realize that you've raised a good kid.
You know, David Brooks, and I think I've quoted this on the show, he wrote a book, and one of the points he makes in his book is that there's two kinds of resumes in our lives. One is the resume we build throughout our career and our lives. But there's another resume, and that's the resume of what we want people to say about us at our funerals. And he says that we'll be better off if we start building the latter resume now. And if we start building that resume, then we'll probably be happier in our day-to-day lives and we'll be better role models, not just for our children and grandchildren, but for our communities, our extended families. And, you know, you make your contribution to making the world a better place. One thing I always beg parents to do is do what you do as an act of love for your unborn progeny. That's the big picture. That's the very...
Right, but very then I'll turn it back to you, Dan. When people are so anxious about the economics, about whether their kids are going to have jobs, or about whether or not they're going to keep their own jobs, or whether or not there's going to be a middle class or not, that ability to keep your own sense of... the future in mind, I think, is attenuated.
Well, hard. We've got time for a quick response from Tamar.
Yeah, we were talking before, Luba was talking about these programs being low cost for schools. Being good to each other in our own lives and our own homes feels good right away, and it's free. And that could be how we are going to sustain ourselves in a difficult market.
Well, unfortunately, we are out of time. I want to thank you both so much for joining the conversation. And
thank you, Dan.
Thanks to Luba Fagenberg from Harvard's Making Caring Common project. Well, I want to mention something else. As most of you know, this is our pledge drive this time, and you notice there were no breaks for pledge, and that was an act of kindness on the part of WHYY out of respect for this show and out of respect for the fact that the show is winding down. And I want you to know that this station respected and held this show close to them for 30 years. No other station would have done that. Please honor them, honor what they're about, and honor all of this as an act of kindness. Please support this program, this show. 888-345-9499. The engineer has been Adam Staniszewski. Elizabeth Perez-Loon is our EP of audio content. Mike and Scott's our EP. Trin Thatch is our intern. Larry Roebling produces the show.